We'll call the House Tax Committee to order. If members will please take their seats. We do not have a quorum yet, so we will not take any action on the minutes at this point. But we'll start out with House File 337. Representative Lilly, when we do have a quorum, will move House File 337. Representative Lilly, welcome to your committee. Do you have any amendments to your bill? I don't think you do.
Mr. Chair, I believe we have no amendments today.
Okay. So, Representative Lilly, welcome to the Tax Committee. If you could please present your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I know everybody's moving about and with other committees and other commitments, but this is a piece of legislation that will help many communities around the state, Anoka, Shakopee, North St. Paul, and some others that have municipal power being offered to their communities. And today with me I have some experts, and I think I'll pass it to them since they know quite a bit more about the bill, and maybe as members come in they can hear more. But I'll have Kelsey Dowland tell you about what we're trying to accomplish here. There's, just so you know, there's a pretty fancy little thing that's being sent out here, and take a look at that, and kind of gives you an idea of what we're trying to do. And I believe the chair has been kind enough to do these sort of things in the past in some other communities, and we're hoping that the committee might consider to do it again. It's been through property taxes, and so anyways.
Thank you, Representative. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kelsey Dowland. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. I work for Avant Energy in Minneapolis. The Minnesota Municipal Power Agency is comprised of 11 member communities. We are responsible for supplying wholesale power to those member communities. And this is a program that would help the member communities keep their electric rates competitive with other utilities and power suppliers throughout the state. The distributed generation program utilizes electric reciprocating engines and interconnects directly with the distribution systems of our member communities. And what we're proposing is to connect the electricity to the member communities of Shakopee, North St. Paul, Chaska, and Anoka. And this is unique in that it would not require high voltage transmission lines. And it would reduce some of the transmission-related costs that are flowed through to ratepayers in the state of Minnesota. In addition, this would also increase reliability, electricity's reliability for our members. And so in general, this is a program that we're seeking an exemption for the personal property tax on the generation equipment. For about the past 25 years, it's been quite common for generation facilities to come and seek this exemption, and so that's why we're here in front of you today. And I have John Crooks here with us today from the Shakopee Public Utilities to talk with you as well.
Tim. They have really good sun in Shakopee.
Sir, if you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
I'm John Crooks. I'm Utilities Manager with Shakopee Public Utilities.
How do you spell your last name?
Spell it. C-R-O-O-K-S.
Oh, okay. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak in support of House File 337. As stated...
Excuse me, Mr. Crooks. Before you get started, we'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Mr. Crooks.
Thank you. I'm Utilities Manager, as I stated, with Shakopee Public Utilities. We're a municipal power utility, which means we're a little different from the co-ops and the investor-owned utilities that we have in the state, that we're locally owned, we're locally operated, and locally governed. As Ms. Dowland stated, the three main portions that we have in supplying electricity to our customers and to our member communities is the generation, which is supplied by MMPA, and there's transmission, which that load is carried by the high transmission lines to the member communities and cities around the country. And there's distribution, which is what we do. We're a distribution utility that once we have secured that capacity, we distribute that to our customers and to our residents. This project is unique because we would be essentially not dealing with that middle part of the equation, which is the high voltage transmission lines. We would have the generation would be locally produced in Shakopee and would be fed directly into our distribution equipment at our substations. There's an advantage to that. It was stated that the reliability is there and redundancy. So with that local generation of power, we're able to provide that local power. And if there would ever be a reason for that plant to essentially be out of service, we can rely on those high voltage transmission lines and get that service from another source. It's a very efficient way to provide electricity to our customers because we don't have to deal with the line loss or that loss of some of that value of that electricity as it's carried across those high voltage lines. So we see a value that we get a higher level of that electricity produced from that plant. And there's also a way that in the long-term ability of Shakopee Public Utilities and these member communities to have this type of generation to help keep essentially a lid on some of those escalating costs as we see in the future with maybe purchasing electricity across the high voltage lines and or from coal generated facilities. We also believe there's economic development portion with a plant like this because a lot of companies, especially what we hear about now are data centers and the IT companies want to make sure that they have that electricity load essentially guaranteed. And so we have that by having redundancy built in our distribution lines and also now with a potential project like this of having that electricity locally generated, and if there is a problem, like I stated before, that we have that backup coming across the distribution lines. These plants are looking between a size of 25 at the top end down to 5 kilowatts, and to put that in perspective, Shakopee, which has been a very fast-growing community over the last 10 years, has a peak load in the summertime of about 100 megawatts. And during this type of year, it runs maybe about half that, about 50 megawatts. So our plant like this can be sized to carry essentially half the load that we have in Shakopee. So we think that's very good, too, to let our existing customers know, our residents, and also future development that may come into the city. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer those at this time.
Thank you, sir. And before we do that, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for the bill or with concerns? And members, this is a bill that is very similar to ones that we've done in the past. The last one I remember, I think, was Fairmont, and there's been different ones around the state that we've done, given them this language here. So any questions from members? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lilly, first of all, it's a good bill. I'll be voting in favor of it, and we should do that. But as I stated to you in the Energy Committee, I would just recommend that you do additional research on this so that we don't have these we come by onesie and twosies with these bills every time, but it's a generally accepted practice that these are given property tax exemptions in the communities, and we should just implement a statewide policy for this to allow for this. It's not controversial. I'm not aware of anyone who's opposed to it, and so I'll just, again, encourage you to do that, but I will support your bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Garofalo. Thank you for the suggestion. I'm new to taxes, and so it's a new path for me, and appreciate your advice.
Any other questions from members? Thank you very much. We will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Lonely, and Ms. Dolan and Mr. Crooks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Item next, we have House File 1092. And just looking, Representative Poppy, if you'd please come forward. Just looking at the agenda here, and I don't know quite how you want to handle this because I see there's a House File 386. Erdahl, it looks pretty much the same. Are we doing these together or separate? Chair Poppy, what's your preference?
I think to do it separately, but the presentation can be maybe somewhat together.
I'll defer to however you want to do this,
a little
Chair
bit different.
Poppy.
It's a little different.
Okay, well, let's go with yours then. I will move House File 1092. Are there any amendments to 1092?
Actually, Mr. Chair, we will not be doing an amendment.
The A1 amendment? Okay. Please present your bill, Chair Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I'd ask is if it would be possible for either Mr. Michael or if I could have the Department of Revenue come up. It's a technical adjustment in this bill, and I'd like to have an expert be able to come and present, walk through it a little bit.
Certainly.
If that's possible.
Mr. Michael?
Members of the committee, I'll briefly run this. What this bill does is to make a variety of clarifying changes in the the qualified small business and qualified farm property subtractions or deductions that were enacted by the 2011 legislature. I don't know how important it is to go into all of the excruciating minute details, but I'll try to hit some of the highlights. If you look at Section 1, which amends the definitions provisions, the important thing here is that under the language that's in law now, property that's owned in trust form, which is a common thing, does not clearly qualify for the exemption. And so what this change does is that it says that a family member, which is has to be, in order to be a qualified heir, you have to be a family member, includes a trust where the beneficiaries are all family members. So what that does is it means that under the under this exemption or deduction, there's a requirement that the heirs own the property and use it in certain ways for 3 years. And this will allow, if that ownership is in trust form, for the exemption to still apply, and so that it doesn't have to be directly in the ownership of the individual. Section 2 of the bill clarifies that ownership interests that are where it's deemed that the decedent is owns it under the Internal Revenue Code provisions, that that qualifies as property that's owned by the decedent. And again, this will allow certain kinds of trust ownerships to occur. The other change, another important change that this makes is that it strikes the current law language that requires material participation and instead substitutes a provision that says under federal tax law this must not have been a passive activity during that 3 year period, which is a sort of a clearer standard. Under current law, property that's cash doesn't qualify as small business property. Now, a business may have some working capital that's in cash, but that does not qualify. And this bill expands this to say it's not only cash, but it's also publicly traded securities that are held. So if they've got listed stocks or that sort of thing, that would not qualify for the exemption. It's only going to be, you know, more classic business assets like equipment and real estate and so forth. A third thing that that Section 2 does is if it's a sole proprietor that owns the business was a sole proprietorship and then the qualifying heir is the sole proprietor, it allows the heir to replace the property with similar property. This isn't a problem if it's held in corporate ownership form because then the assets are the corporate shares, but this would allow, you know, for example, if the business has a machine and sells that machine and buys a new machine to do this essentially the same function, that the three-year test would not be violated. So you'd still satisfy the three-year test even though you bought a new pickup truck rather than the old pickup truck. Section 3 of the bill gets into the definition of qualified farm property. Clarifies that basically any land that is owned by an entity that qualifies to own ag land can qualify, so this brings in certain additional ownership structures. And it eliminates the requirement that the qualified heirs materially participate in the trade or business and instead makes the test that the qualified heir has to, the property has to continue to be classified as the homestead of the heir. So the real test will be not are you farming, but is the property still homestead farm property? So we're not going to look at whether or not under the bill you would not look at whether the family member that received it is actually driving the tractor, but they could qualify to rent the property out, which under Minnesota property tax law, you can still have a homestead farm even if you rent the land out to someone else that's using it as a farm. And so this, that will allow that to go on, whereas I think under the current language, the test might be if the decedent had been renting out the land, it may be that you could rent out the land, but if the decedent was actually farming it, then you would have to farm it. So this is a little more flexible test than that. Section 4 modifies the recapture tax, and the recapture tax, just to refresh people's memories, applies if this three-year rule is violated. So in other words, if the heir does not continue to use the business, operate the business for 3 years, or in the case of farm property, is not continue to be classified as farm property. So this modifies that to be consistent with a couple of the other changes, and again allows an exception for this replacement property provision that I talked about before under subdivision 2, so that the recapture tax would not be triggered if a sole proprietor sells an old pickup truck and buys a new pickup truck, because that's replacement property. So even though that machine or that pickup truck was included in the exemption, the fact that they disposed of it within that three-year period won't disqualify them if they buy new business assets to replace that. So that's sort of a very general description of what the bill does.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Chair Poppy?
Thank you very much, Mr. Michael. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have some testifiers that I'd like to bring forward. The first would be Stephen Franta, who's an attorney and deals with people who are trying to lay out their plans. And
okay, just to kind of see where we're at here, is there anyone that wishes to testify with concerns on this bill? Anyone else that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill? Okay, we have several other folks wish to testify on behalf. Seeing that there's no opposition, I think you know what that means, that we just kind of we get things on the record and we go forward. Please state your name. If you could please spell your last name.
My name is Stephen J. Franta. Last name is spelled F-R-A-N-T-A.
Welcome to the Tax Committee, sir.
Thank you very much. I greatly appreciate the opportunity and your time here to participate in this hearing, and as well, I'd like to thank Representative Poppy in authoring this bill. I think this bill goes a long ways in carrying out the original intent of the statutory enactment, and that is to assist family farms and businesses to proceed further into the next generation, particularly the provision amending or clarifying that trust should qualify. Now, one of the things that I see quite often as a practicing attorney, I represent hundreds of farmers, and I belong to an organization of 11 other attorneys who represent hundreds of farmers. And there's sometimes a misconception about trust, that they're kind of a diversion around things, and it's not really true. In the farm estate planning arena, trusts are used for convenience of having things organized and structured in such a way that we can avoid a probate, so, which in turn takes a burden off the judiciary, and which also allows for the families to have a private trust settlement instead of a probate when it's not needed to carry out the wishes of the family. And so the Department of Revenue and the bill originally as written did not allow for trusts, or was not interpreted to allow for trust, and this amendment bill fixes that. And the reason it's good is because in my practice here in the last 10 years, I have gone from a very few trust planning clients to great many, many trust planning clients, because as consumers, farmers have found that this is a good package for them and gives them good value for their planning. What it also allows them to do is to allow for the succession of the farm, for the use of the trust to give instructions if they become incapacitated, etc., again, avoiding living probate, the guardianship, conservatorship. So I think it goes a long way, and it's really, really important. And just to clarify again, the trust is really, I'm talking about a revocable living trust, which is really an entity, which is really a device, a strategy, a what I call a vehicle that is where the trust owns property, land, machinery, equipment, just but it's treated for all other purposes just as if the individual farmer owned it themselves. Okay, so that's the one thing that's very, very good about this bill. It allows for that use, continued use. The other part that is really, really important is that for decades, for 30 plus years, attorneys across the country have utilized trusts for in the estate planning arena on the federal level, and now of course on the state level, to allow for the support of surviving spouse. The public policy of the legislation is that we're going to allow marital deduction. We're going to allow the use of the exemptions for to take care of spouse, surviving spouse. Husband passes away, we want to create a trust for the benefit of surviving spouse, wife, for as long as she lives. And by not allowing the use of this kind of a trust to qualify for this exemption, puts a real burden on the family farm moving forward. And so I think I'll just leave it with those remarks. I think it's really a very good bill to alleviate some of the problems, and it goes a long way to alleviate the problem in not allowing for trust.
Any questions for Mr. Franta from members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Franson, this is not an area I know much about, so I'm learning. But can you tell me, is this a... this bill only deals with agricultural businesses. Do we have similar things in law for trusts with other types of small businesses? Are we creating a precedent here that would apply to other businesses?
Mr. Frank.
Or maybe that could be to Mr. Michael.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, this bill, there are two exemptions or deductions now that apply to both farms and small businesses of up to $4 million. These changes that allow the trust forms apply to both types of businesses. So, and it's also a common strategy as part of estate planning, if you own a small business, to put that in trust form as a way to, you know, arrange for transfer of the property. So oftentimes, you know, the shares of stock in an S corporation, or not an S, in a partner, or the partnership ownership could very well be in a trust for the heir, because it's put in a family trust to maximize the marital deduction and so forth. And so, yes, these provisions also apply in the small business context and will enable trust ownership to qualify.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
Any other questions for members for Mr. Franta? Thank you, sir. If we go with Mr. Hickey, and I believe Mr. Peterson, Mr. Raddatz, why don't you all three, well, why don't two of you come up anyways? Got a couple seats here. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the state's largest business group in terms of entities and the largest small business representative with 13,000 members across the state. And wanted to thank Representative Poppy for authoring this law, and for you helping to pass this back in 2011. Mr. Stand-in Chairman, it was a very important law to get passed to try to help out family-held businesses and farmers, and we support this bill to try to better clarify and make it easier for the Department of Revenue to work with this law and to allow more family-held businesses and farms to take advantage of it. And so I think it's really needed, and we need some clarification, and appreciate Representative Hoppe bringing it forward, and just wanted to add our support, and going to be brief for once. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Any questions from committee members for Mr. Hickey? Thank you, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Chris Raddatz, Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Farm Bureau. And I, too, want to thank Representative Poppy and the members who are on the Tax Committee in 2011 for passing this important provision. This is a good bill. It clarifies what we to make it work. And I'll just leave it at that. I'll be even briefer.
Okay. Mr. Peterson, Thank you, Mr. Any questions for Mr. Raddatz from members? Thank you, Mr. Raddatz. Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Peterson, I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. And we also just echo the comments made by the last testifiers. We also support the legislation. I've had more appreciate the legislation passed in 2011, but as a lot of people began to look at that, realized that they were in a trust and had concerns about that. And this legislation goes a long way to ending some of that uncertainty that's both in the planning for a lot of farmers for trusts and then those that are in trusts currently and trying to figure out what's going to happen when they pass on. I also would mention that since 2011, we've made more changes to the federal farm estate tax. And as I understand it, the federal estate tax allows for trusts, exemption allows for trusts. And so that's what conformed to that. So, thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Peterson from the Farmers Union? Chair Pop, if I've learned one thing over the years around here is if you have the Farm Bureau and the Farmers Union and the NFIB, you got a pretty good shot.
Thank you.
Wouldn't you think?
I hope so.
One question I would have, Chair Poppy, is has the department signed off on this? Have you worked with the department on this?
I do have somebody from the Department of Revenue who can just come to.
Maybe get Ms. Von Mosch down just for the record. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Susan Von Mosch with the Department of Revenue. We have been working with Representative Poppy, with Senator Coonan on this, the bill language, to ensure that it is administratable from the perspective of the department and to try to meet the goals that the authors had in mind, along with the testifiers that you heard here today. So we have been involved with the development of this bill.
Thank you very much. And just for the record, earlier in session, I was quite concerned about some of the developments on interpreting the statute from 11. And I thank you and the department for working with the affected parties to get this thing moving forward. So,
thank you.
Any other questions for anyone? If not, we'll lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Chair Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, we have item next. We have Representative Erdahl and House File 386. I will move House File 386. Now, I'm a little confused. This one was a lower bill number, but they're not the same. Representative Erdahl, could you please explain the differences in your bill from what we just heard, maybe?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I believe they are minor differences. If we look on Bill 386, lines 2.28 to 2.32 are deleted, and on page 4, on line 4.20, the words in 4.19, with respect to the qualified interest disposed, is deleted from my bill and is in Representative Poppy's bill. Lines 4.24, 4.26, also deleted, section D. So if you're really interested in what those deletions did, Mr. Michaels, I think, could explain. But, you know, my thought is, since basically you pretty much heard this bill, I could call the same five people over and we could do it again. Or
we might not.
Or, yeah. After hearing from, I'll just say this, after hearing from small businesses, farmers, and accountants, I was pleased to introduce House File 386 early in the session. House File 1092, Representative Poppy's bill, really is so good that I can hardly tell these two apart. And Representative Poppy has great support. I strongly encourage you to support her bill. Or mine, if you really want to.
Okay. For the record, thank you, Representative Erdahl. For the record, Mr. Michael, if you could just basically where the difference is here so the committee knows where we're at.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Erdahl has correctly identified the language differences between the two bills. I'll go over what those language differences do. On page 2, that new clause 6 basically says that in applying the small business exemption, you don't take into account property that can qualify for the farm exemption. So it's sort of a compartmentalizing clarification provision that says farmland can only qualify for the farm exemption and it cannot qualify under the small business exemption. I'm not sure in any circumstances where that'll make a material difference in the amount of tax that's owed. The two changes on page 4 are more important probably for substantive purposes. The first one, which is the one that's on line 19 and 20, basically says for the recapture tax, if you think about the way the recapture tax works, this is an instance where during this 3-year period that the qualified heir is required to continue to own and use the property either as a business or as retain its status as homestead farmland. What this language does is says that, let's say you dispose of, let me put it this way, let's say you've got $2 million under this exemption and you dispose of $100,000 worth of property. What this says is the recapture tax would only apply with respect to the qualified interest that you dispose of. So it would be the $100,000 that you dispose of, not the entire $2 million exemption. On lines 24 through 26, what that essentially permits is it, and up on top on lines 4.12, where it inserts that term qualified entity, what this allows is the owner of a property, again during this period when the recapture tax could apply, to change the form of ownership. So, for example, let's say the business or farm was owned in a partnership form, and the family members decide that they would prefer to have it in corporate form or vice versa. This would allow them to essentially change the form to put it in a corporate or partnership or LLC or something like that without triggering the recapture tax, provided that that qualifying entity, whether it's a corporation or an LLC, is owned only by family members that could qualify as under the definition of family member earlier. So those are the three differences.
Okay, any questions for the author? Okay, we'll lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Item next, House File 1431, Mahoney. And Representative Mahoney, I will move House File number 1431. I do not see any amendments at all.
I try to keep my bills as simple as possible, Mr. Chair.
Chair Mahoney, if you could please describe your bill for the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House File 1431 is modifies the sales tax exemption on data centers. We change it from we reduce the minimum square footage from 30,000 to 25,000. The minimum required investment from 50 million to 20 million, and made the period, we extended the period that it can be claimed from 24 to 48 months. I have some people to testify here. The short version of their testifying is that this can be a big boon to data centers in the state. Hopefully we can find, without much of a change in terms of dollar figures, or at least it surprised me that it was as small a change as it was. And hopefully we can find that in the budget someplace.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mahoney. First of all, is there anyone that wishes to testify with concerns regarding House File 1431? If I could have a show of hands, how many folks would like to testify on behalf of House File 1431? Okay, I just see two. If the two gentlemen could come forward here, we will have your testimony. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Tollefson. I'm the manager of public policy at the Minnesota High Tech Association.
Sir, could you please spell your last name?
T-O-L-L-E-F-S-O-N.
Oh, okay. Okay. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill adjusts the current qualified data tax center tax exemption to make it better fit the industry as it operates today. The original law was passed in order to attract data centers to Minnesota, but the numbers turn out to be too large for most data centers, developers and operators. In fact, only one company that we know of has utilized the exemption. Minnesota has a number of barriers to entry, and we currently lag behind other states in terms of the incentives we provide companies to build data centers here. The Minnesota High Tech Association's goal is to make Minnesota one of the top five high-tech corridors in the country, fueling Minnesota's prosperity through innovation and technology, and attracting data centers and building Minnesota's reputation as a logical place to build data centers are key elements to that goal. We are supportive of the original incentive, and we thank the committee for supporting it originally. We would now like to expand this opportunity to other companies who are building smaller data centers than what the current legislation provides. So the current incentive requires an investment of $50 million over 2 years, which turns out to be just too much, too fast for most companies. This language would change the requirements to $20 million over 4 years, much more likely investments given today's data center needs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for committee members for Mr. Tollefson? And if you please give my regards to your boss, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next gentleman, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Livingston, and I'm the president of Hybrid Data, a data center development company. I thank you for this opportunity. My jobs promote data center development in Minnesota. Our state has a natural advantage over other states in the country due to its cool environment. We also have a high number of well-educated people, so it's an excellent place to develop and operate these types of facilities. Yet we compete with the rest of the country for the attention of users and developers, and we are trying to advocate leveling the playing field a little bit as compared to other states who offer incentives beyond what's being considered in this amendment. Our state's underserved when it comes to co-location facilities within the local community, which are increasingly integral to the development of growth of local businesses and attracting other businesses to this area. Realities addressed by local companies on a daily basis, anywhere from the small rack and space user to the larger enterprise users. These language adjustments relate directly to the goals of local and out-of-state companies currently considering data center construction. Large-scale developments, such as you've seen with Google, Apple, and Microsoft, don't have the same objectives when they're building data centers in their site selection. The typical data center user is much smaller than that, and they have uses that start out gradual and increase over time. Unlike those large companies, most data center businesses are comprised of a wide range of needs, yes, in various sizes. You know, I think that John has covered most of the things that are relative to what the amendments address. What this bill does is creates opportunity for companies both outside the area and inside Minnesota to develop new data centers to address the market imbalance that we have here. We're just horribly underserving our local community. And thank you for the opportunity to address this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Livingston. Any questions for Mr. Tollefson, Livingston, or the author from members? Representative Garofalo.
Questions or just comments on the bill?
Comments on the bill or questions, whatever you prefer.
Sure. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, Representative Mahoney, I want to thank you for introducing this bill. I'm a big fan of it. This is a really good idea. If you look at the things that have happened in Austin, Texas, and in North Carolina, we got caught sleeping at the switch here in Minnesota. There's no reason that these data warehouses that are occurring in other facilities really shouldn't be in the state of Minnesota. Again, these are the sort of high-end IT jobs that our state is really, our education system and our demographics are set up for. This is a really good idea, and we should be doing it. And it highlights that cost matters. Cost is a variable And these jobs are really, really good jobs we're seeing coming out of our math and science sectors. I'm not just saying it because I'm a network engineer and I work in the IT field. But it does highlight, it highlights what a good public policy would be to create jobs. Now, unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of other bills move through this legislature that do the exact opposite of what this bill is trying to accomplish. We have bills that are raising the cost of electricity, which are a significant disincentive to have data warehousing take place here. We have other bills that are significantly increasing taxes on the hardworking taxpayers of Minnesota. But this bill right here, this is a job provider. This is a job creator. It's going to help out a lot of people, help out those college graduates to stay in Minnesota, to have their raise their families here, have good jobs, and I really support it, and I hope it's included in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vancells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To either Representative Mahoney or your testifiers, could you tell us a little bit about where all these wonderful jobs are going to be created and how soon they're going to be created and where they're going to be located and how these great jobs at these data centers are going to impact businesses in Duluth or Grand Forks or Grand Rapids?
The gentleman from Ramsey.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted you to understand that Grand Rapids is going to be excluded. Mr. Chair, Representative Vanzell, just in the metro area alone, we have closing in on 1,000 high-tech companies. Each one of these high-tech companies uses a level of data, and they have to run it through a center or store it in a center. We are trying as a state, as a society, to expand our broadband, and as we expand the broadband, we will be putting companies, whether they're in Grand Rapids or Roseau or Worthington or the Twin Cities or any place, you will need more data centers, and they can go their routing system. The farther, and just like electricity, the farther you route it, the harder it is to move it from one point, or the more you lose from one point to the other. So where they're going to be, it kind of hinges on if we can keep our young people in greater Minnesota.
Which
we'd like to. I mean, I'd like to have them here in Twin Cities, but I'm just as well having them in Grand Rapids or anyplace else. If we do the things that we have to do, such as data centers, broadband, continue to invest in our educational system, provide a quality of life that is next to none, we can do that. But in terms of if you want hard data as to where it's going to go, I don't think anyone can look in a crystal ball and give it to you.
Representative Anfield,
do you want to add something?
Any other questions? I would just say that I believe Mr. Michael didn't this start out in the 2011 tax bill? And it looks to me like I just made it a bit too big. And so what Representative Mahoney's asking for is to bring it down a little bit, spread the time out a little bit, is what we're looking at here. So, okay, with that, any other questions? Thank you, Chair Mahoney. We will lay House File 1431 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Chair.
Item next, we will go to Chair Hornstein, I believe. I will move House File 1440. Chair Hornstein, I'm just looking. Do you have any amendments you're aware of?
No, not that I'm aware of, Mr. Chairman.
I've got a few. Just kidding.
I know. You were the chair last year when I presented this. You're the chair this year.
We heard it last year.
I know. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Chair Hornstein, welcome to the Tax Committee, and members, I have moved House File 1440. Chair Hornstein, if you could please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. I know many of you have heard this bill in the past. It's kind of a rite of spring. We have the snow melting, the baseball season, budget bills, and I bring the tax haven bill to the tax committee. Mr. Chairman, I feel very strongly about this, as you know, and that's why I've carried it since I've been here. I think it's just a simple matter of fairness. When we have individual taxpayers and small business owners paying their fair share, and then we have some corporations that are literally hiding their money in overseas tax havens. And I've always appreciated the way that Mr. Michael has drafted this bill, because we are able to name these, and it's a very good thing for the geography bee. The countries come and go, but the problem is the same. And that is that we have $38 million per biennium that we can capture for our general fund if we eliminate these tax havens from being utilized by certain businesses. We don't know which ones, of course, but certain businesses in the state of Minnesota are utilizing them. So, on page 2, line 16, I don't know if Mr. Michael could comment. I know there was a run on the banks in Cyprus, and I'm not sure if that's a really good tax haven anymore, but as far as I know, it's still on the list. But anyway, you get a sense of where this money that should be in Minnesota is being captured. So rather than hiding out in Granada somewhere, maybe we could spend this money for our public schools, health care, infrastructure, and the like. So that's my bill. I have a number of testifiers. I'm happy to take questions or whatever you'd like to do, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Hornstein, let's get in to see what we have for testifiers. Is there anyone that wish to testify with concerns on this bill? Okay. How many folks do we have wish to testify on behalf of the bill, supporting it? Okay. Why don't we go with the one with concerns, and then we will go with the folks who want to testify supporting the bill. And I noticed on the House research we have Jordan twice. Is there a reason for that, Chair Hornstein?
Because Representative Biskins complained to me that Jordan was on once, so we put it on twice. No.
Okay,
he's from Jordan, so he always joked with me that, why do you have his city on the list? But, no, I'm not quite sure why, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Kaduna. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I'm here to speak in opposition to House File 1440. There's numerous reasons that we believe this is bad tax policy for Minnesota. One thing is really looking at the larger policy question. What is the policy rationale for Minnesota to tax income earned outside of Minnesota and also earned outside of the United States? The trend in other countries is really to go to a territorial basis of income tax for a corporate taxation. And that means they just tax the income earned within their countries. And the reason these other countries have done this is they want to attract and strengthen the ability of their companies to be able to compete globally, to attract capital from abroad, and also to create headquartered jobs in their country. So this is going in the opposite direction in most other countries as well. I also disagree with the underlying premise of the bill that a company is doing business, if they're doing business in this list of these countries, that they're there for tax evasion purposes. There's many reasons that a company would be doing business in these countries. Access to foreign markets is one, foreign investment is another. It also allows Minnesota multinational companies to compete on a level playing field with their non-U.S. multinationals. Another concern with the bill is the list of the countries that are listed as tax haven countries. I have a handout that's hopefully going around at this point. The OECD no longer keeps a list of tax haven countries. I think this list was originally put out in about 1990. Instead, what the OECD has done is they're now working with the U.S. and other, the major developed countries, working on with these countries for the effective exchange of tax information and also on transparency. So you can see from the handout that I've done from the OECD website is that these countries have all agreed to these standards. All these countries have been removed from a so-called list of tax havens, and they're no longer considered tax havens. So I wanted to make sure that was known to the committee as well. We also believe that this type of policy, when you're looking at the taxation of foreign income, is really best decided at the federal level. It's important for the federal government to be speaking with one voice on trade issues and with our trading partners. I know when this bills have been advanced before, I know tax chairs have had ambassadors from other countries come in to speak with them regarding their concerns. Probably Chair Lynchesky and Chair Davis have had ambassadors come in, so it certainly does get the attention of other countries as well that do not appreciate being called tax havens. My understanding of the list of states that have these is Montana's one, West Virginia, and I believe Alaska might have some sort of form of it. None of these states have any Fortune 500 companies, so I believe the impact on Minnesota might be a little different than these other states that we're looking at. We believe we should really focus how we can encourage job growth in Minnesota and the ability for our companies to be competing globally and not advance bills that will put Minnesota's multinational businesses at a competitive disadvantage with non-U.S. companies and non-Minnesota companies. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Any questions from members for Ms. Cadoon? Okay, thank you very much. Chair Hornstein, if you'd like to bring up folks in the order you'd like, that'd be great.
Sure. Now I have a small business owner, Todd Michelson. Jennifer Shawbuck is, I believe, here from the AFL-CIO. Someone from so I'll just step aside and let them do their thing.
And to the folks that are testifying, if we could, when someone's finished and the questions are done, if we could vacate the chair for someone else, we'll go through that way. The gentleman, if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
My name is Todd Michelson, and I'm a small business owner.
Welcome, committee, sir.
Thank you. I built my business around an invention of mine, and we assemble and test these and other products out of the old Tonka Toys building on Lake Minnetonka, and we sell to countries all around the world. I support the passage of HF 1440 because closing the tax haven loophole in Minnesota will level the playing field for all business owners in our state. Despite the fact that 98% of businesses in Minnesota have 100 or less employees, and collectively these same small businesses are the state's largest employer, far too often public policy favors large corporations, and that's certainly the case with the tax haven loophole. When a company is able to avoid taxes through this loophole, it gains a competitive price advantage over small businesses like mine. My business can't take advantage of such tax dodges. In using these tax havens, corporations also avoid paying their share of the public services they benefit from. Costs must then be shifted to other taxpayers or translate into reduced investment in infrastructure, education, public safety, and other services that support a healthy economy and benefit all businesses. Minnesota has the most Fortune 500 companies per capita in the U.S. We have a very welcoming business climate. And with our effective corporate tax rate being the 11th lowest in the country, we've got plenty of room to close tax loopholes. Currently, Minnesota leads the nation in per capita loss of revenue to the tax haven loophole. By closing it, not only small business owners, but all Minnesotans stand to benefit. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michelson. Any questions from committee members for Mr. Michelson? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Michelson. You mentioned that Minnesota had the 11th lowest effective corporate tax rate. Could you tell me what that rate is?
Mr. Michelson?
I don't have it in the top of my head exactly what that rate is.
Representative Bloom?
Well, thank you. If you could submit that, because it's contrary to other information that we have with regards to you know what our reported corporate tax rate, and it generally is one of the highest in the nation.
I can tell you that it is from a study that was done by Ernst & Young, the Ernst & Young report in 2010.
Mr. Mixon, if you could provide that to the committee, that'd be great.
Okay.
Representative Loon, any follow-up?
No, thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Michelson? Thank you very much, sir. The next gentleman, if you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Yes, my name, Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Paul Slack. I'm pastor of New Creation Church in Minneapolis, and I'm president of Isaiah.
Sir, could you please spell your last name?
S-L-A-C-K.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you again, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you for this opportunity to testify today. Part of a pastor's job is to study Scripture, to try to understand how Scripture calls us to live out the values of our faith in relationship with other people. Scripture teaches a prophetic witness in a Judeo-Christian tradition. The prophets do not mince words when the life of the community is out of balance, when the needs of all are not equally prioritized, and when the economic system is not fair, when some find ways to not pay their fair share. The prophets condemn systems where equity does not exist, where opportunity is only for some, where resources are hoarded by the few at the expense of the many, and where the most vulnerable are oppressed and robbed of dignity. Over the past 2 years, I've seen many hardworking members of my congregation struggle to pay their mortgage after the businesses they've worked for 30 years went bankrupt or decided that it no longer needed them because they could send their jobs offshore and pay the new workers less. Some of their employers are making record profits, as many of us know here. A few weeks ago, through a report in the Star Tribune on the research of U.S. Prig, I learned that the Minnesota Department of Revenue reported that the median tax paid by corporations in Minnesota is zero. Pretty overwhelming. I also learned that Minnesota has lost $1.95 billion in tax revenue due to multinational corporations using tax havens and tax loopholes. These facts are shocking. The prophets of old would not be silent in the face of such unfairness, such inequity, such, yes, greed. We should not be either. As a huge majority of the citizens of this state pay their fair share to make this state run, to educate our children, to care for the most vulnerable, these huge corporations seem only to be taking care of their own executives, and their own shareholders. There was a time not so long ago that corporations cared about people and their families. They saw it as their responsibility to treat those who had worked for them hard for many, many years, to treat them fairly, and to invest in the communities around them. I'm glad to say that there are still a few corporations who still consider it good business to treat their employees fairly and to invest in the communities that have supported them. Unfortunately, those corporations are all too fair. As a voice of faith, I don't just stand to condemn those corporations who refuse to invest in the strength of community, indeed the strength of Minnesota, but to declare with the prophets of old that there is a better way. That way always begins by listening to the cries of the most vulnerable. There are many needs in Minnesota. Making sure that all people have access to quality, affordable health care. Creating the people's exchange. Closing the racial achievement gap in education in Minnesota. Making sure advocacy programs for victims of domestic violence are available across our state. Making public transportation a vehicle for economic development. Closing the racial jobs gap. Expanding on background checks for those who want to purchase weapons. These are just a few ways to follow this better way. Today I would like to say that we need to work together to find a way to invest in all the people of the state, to all pay our fair share, to all be a part of building a better and stronger Minnesota. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify, and I hope that we support this bill.
Thank you, Pastor Slack. Any questions for the gentleman? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Pastor Slack. You said something about the average or the median income for corporations you learned is zero. Is that what it was? Could you say what that was again?
Yes,
Pastor
that was
Slack.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair and committee members. Yes, that was reported in U.S. Prig. I think it was about a month ago that they did a report and had consulted with the Minnesota Commission of Revenue that the medium tax was zero for corporations in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I haven't heard that before, Mr. Slack. If you could, can you share that with the committee?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'd be glad to share that reference.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very interested to see that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, Representative Drazkowski, there was a GAO study in 2007 that established pretty clearly that the U.S. vast majority of U.S. corporations reported zero tax liability as well. So it may raise some eyebrows around this committee table, as it well should, but it's one of those facts that's one of the best-kept secrets in most tax committees and legislatures throughout the nation. So I can certainly get you a copy of the GAO study as well.
Representative Ronbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And was it Reverend Slack?
Did you say? Chair, yes.
Pastor?
Yes.
Pastor.
Or Reverend?
Pastor, Reverend, neither one.
Rabbi? I mean.
Well, Mr. Chair, Rabbi doesn't quite work for me.
Which you prefer, sir?
Pastor's fine.
Pastor. Representative Ronbeck.
Yes, thank you. As a former small business owner myself, and actually, two businesses I've owned. I mean, I always thought that the creation of jobs was the role of business, and that that is a significant contribution when it comes, you know, because most businesses form because somebody sacrifices, somebody risks a lot of money, somebody may have substantial losses over the course of making a business successful, may have to rebound from total failure to continue the pursuit. I hear you as saying something very damning of the business community, and I frankly can't understand it. So isn't it enough to create, as we have in Minnesota, 2.4 million jobs in the private sector?
Pastor Slack?
Mr. Chair and committee members, creating jobs certainly should be one part of what businesses do. Also, investing in the communities and in the overall strength of communities around them should also be a part of the responsibilities of business, as it is the part of everyone who lives, who works in the state of Minnesota. To do what we can, not escape our responsibility to pay our fair share of taxes, to generally invest in the strength of everything around them. And unfortunately, I believe that today many corporations are escaping that responsibility and are no longer concerned about the overall strength of everyone. They're more concerned about their bottom lines and also more concerned about just how much money they can take home in their own pockets.
Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair and Reverend Slack, you're putting on them, you're imposing a tremendous responsibility, it seems to me, that is just, you know, coming from, I don't know what part of society. We do have nonprofits, that whole sector, it's growing, it's vibrant, it's doing the good work. I just don't know where you're coming from. It seems very harsh to be saying exactly the kind of thing you're saying, and it sounds like you want government to impose more and more sort of expectations for the social contribution besides the profit, the taxes, and the job contribution. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Pastor Slack? Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pastor Slack, welcome to the committee, and thanks for coming. I have a question for you about your testimony that $1.9 billion would come back into Minnesota if these corporate tax havens were eliminated. The bill before us only talks about $36 million, not $1.5 billion. $36 million, my math is correct, is about 2% of the total that you're referring to. Where's the difference? Where's the other 98% that you would
refer to? Pastor Slack, what is Chair Hornstein doing with the rest of that money?
He's probably investing in it in all of the needed things we need in our community, education and other things. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Thank you for the question. That information was found in the same data that I quoted earlier. So when I refer the reference to the committee, I'm sure you will find that there. So I don't have a list in front of me, but through the research that was done earlier, that was the amount that was quoted in terms of lost revenue that we have in our state.
And Pastor, if you could provide that to me, that'd be great.
Yes, I would.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you. I think I'm not sure I understood that, Mr. Chair. Maybe you could interpret that for me. I just didn't understand where the 98% is at.
Well, I believe that's the information that the pastor is going to be providing the committee.
Okay.
That we can follow up on. Is that correct, Pastor?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess for the committee's edification, corporate tax income for the state of Minnesota, according to the February forecast, was $2.001 billion. Thought that might be helpful.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Any other questions for the pastor? Thank you very much, sir, for your testimony. I'm sorry, Representative Loon.
Well,
missed you there. Sorry.
That's okay. I guess just a question or an opportunity for the pastor to comment, and then a question I actually would ask Mr. Michael to provide a response for. Pastor, I know that I'm familiar with your organization and somewhat of your mission, but I guess the one thing that I am concerned about, and we talk a lot about this in tax committee, whether taxes are regressive or progressive, and you know, corporate taxes in my review of information are generally viewed to be more regressive because it results in higher costs of goods and services, and that, you know, hits hardest at lower income people in our community. I mean, do you have any concerns about that, or what would be your response to that? Because if we're looking at raising corporate taxes through this proposal, isn't that going to fall in a regressive manner towards some of the people that your organization and mission is to help?
Pastor Slack.
Mr. Chair and committee members, unfortunately, one of the things that I've seen over the years that I've lived and I've worked in Minnesota is that not enough investments actually come into communities that need investments most. And if we have more revenue, we'd have more of an opportunity to certainly invest. And I think there's work that still needs to be done so that those investments can get to the right places. But we want, my organization just want what's fair. We want everybody, not just me, rest of the people in my congregation, and many other hardworking people. We want corporations, those who work and who actually benefit from the state of Minnesota, benefit from working here and benefit through its citizenry, to do what is right and pay what is fair, so that all of us, not just those from the past, but those who children who are being born in the United Education System now, so that all of us can benefit from the opportunities that we all deserve.
Representative Loan.
Thank you, Reverend. I appreciate the answer, and I wonder if Mr. Michael could just give a response. Am I correct in that aren't corporate taxes generally considered to be regressive because they do fall to the ultimate consumers of whatever that business is providing, goods or services?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, the assumptions used in the tax incidence study do allocate a large share of the portion of corporate taxes to consumers. There's a portion of it that's also allocated to capital and a small portion to labor. And so, again, to emphasize on a very long run basis, those economic principles that they used to construct the tax incidence study do assume that most of the corporate tax does flow back to consumers and higher prices. Some of those are consumers nationally, some of them are consumers in Minnesota. And again, that largely reflects the fact that our tax is primarily allocated based on sales, and so one would expect that because that's the way that determines how much tax you owe, that would sort of be the ultimate resting place for the tax burden.
Representative
Loon. Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Michael. That was my recollection as well from looking at that, and I just think it's an important point to highlight that, again, you can raise corporate taxes, you can change the system, but a lot of those taxes, again, are borne by people who may least be able to pay them. So.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and appreciate Mr. Michael giving us, you know, the kind of what I've heard a number of times in this committee about the regressivity of corporate taxation. But I'm just sitting here doing kind of a quick search and on that very question. And what I'm seeing here is that's a very controversial issue. And I wish I had the numbers here in front of me, but we all know that over recent decades, the compensation of corporate executives has just skyrocketed, whereas workers' wages have remained flat. And so it's clear that corporations are sitting on lots and lots of money. They're moving it wherever they want to move it. And I really think we should dig into this idea that, and Mr. Michael, I think, was very careful, as he always is, to not just to say, yes, by golly, this is a regressive and it just gets passed on. No, he didn't say that. I think he was careful and said that there's some evidence. Well, maybe we should examine that evidence a little more closely, because it's very clear that the gap between the super wealthy in this country and those people who are actually working for a living and earning their pay is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that money, you know, corporations are sitting on lots and lots of capital. So to say that if we make them pay a little bit more in taxes, that suddenly is going to come out of the consumer's pocket, I just don't buy that. Consumers also have some choices about what to buy. And at least in situations where corporations are competing for sales to consumers, that should put some moderating influence on that passing along that tax.
Thank you, Representative Liebling.
Representative Lesh and then Loon. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I have a question for Mr. Michael as well. Mr. Michael, if I have a certain rate for corporate franchise tax, which Representative Loon, you described can be regressive depending on how you slice it, and if I as a company report zero tax liability, is that still a regressive tax on me?
Mr. Michael, careful, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, that would not be a tax liability in that case, I think, if you don't have any tax liability. If you have no tax obligation, there's not any tax burden.
Gentleman from Ramsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all.
Representative Loon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for, we could go to a zero corporate tax rate, and they would solve your problem there. Well, I just wanted to point out staff had a copy of the 2013 tax incident study, and just with regards to the table on page 98, which talks about the corporate franchise checks and what percent is borne by Minnesota taxpayers. 44% of that's borne by Minnesota taxpayers. Again, some of it's exported and paid by others, but by far the biggest share is borne by Minnesota consumers. 4% goes to capital, 10% to labor, 44% to consumers, and 41% is exported. So I'm assuming that means consumers or others outside of the state. So that would be good to have that on the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for the pastor? Thank you very much, Pastor Slack. Our next testifier, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Schabach. I'm the legislative director at the Minnesota AFL-CIO.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Minnesota AFL-CIO is a labor federation made up of more than 1,000 affiliated unions representing more than 300,000 working men and women across the state. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 1440. Offshore tax havens, the hidden cost of offshore tax havens compiled by the Boston-based advocacy group USPIRG Education Fund found that Minnesota's $1.95 billion yearly loss in tax revenue is the sixth largest among all states. California, with yearly tax losses estimated at $7.1 billion, topped the list, followed by New York, New Jersey, Illinois, and Pennsylvania. Corporations account for nearly $1.3 billion of Minnesota's yearly losses, while individual taxpayers account for about $629 million, the report said. Our five largest public companies based on revenue, 3M, Best Buy, SuperValue, Target, and United Health Group, collectively had 46 subsidiaries in tax havens as of 2008, according to the report. Recently, 2011, the chairman of the internet giant Google, Eric Schmidt, boasted about his company's avoidance strategies, claiming that he was proud of the steps it had taken to cut its tax bill. In 2007 alone, the California-based company sheltered nearly $10 billion of its revenue in Bermuda, allowing it to avoid some $2 billion in worldwide income taxes. Ordinary people who pay their taxes are tired of seeing hugely profitable companies use every trick in the book to avoid paying their fair share. Data on corporate profitability for 2012 shows the continuation of historic levels of profitability despite excessive unemployment and stagnant wages for workers. Specifically, the share of capital income, such as profits and interest, in the corporate sector increased to 25.6% in 2012, the highest in any year since 1950 to 1951, and far higher than the 19.50 to 1951, and far higher than the 19.9% share prevailing over 1969 to 2007, the five business cycles preceding the financial crisis. Profitability used to be lower when there was high unemployment, but in this downturn, we have already seen the share of income going to profit exceed the high point reached in the last recovery or any time in the last five recoveries. We now have an economy built to assure high corporate profitability even when it's operating far below capacity and when most families and workers are faring poorly. This is further evidence that there is a remarkable disconnect between the fortunes of business and those best off, high-income households, and the vast majority. Often called tax loopholes, tax avoidance schemes, the IRS now calls them abusive offshore tax avoidance schemes. No matter what you call them, they're not fair. Taxes are the forgotten element in the corporate social responsibility debate. Companies do not make profit merely by using investors' capital. They also use the societies in which they operate, whether it be the physical infrastructure provided by the state or the people the state has educated. Tax is the return due on this investment by the society from which companies benefit. I again ask for your support of House File 1440, and I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schaubach. Any questions for Ms. Schaubach? Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Schaubach. You had mentioned Google and the fact that they, I guess, have $10 billion in revenue that is offshore and that we could collect if we wanted to. Is that a part of the bill here? Do you know?
Ms. Schaubach?
Not as far as I know.
Okay.
How would it help close that loophole? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schaubach, how do we go about doing that? As a member of the Tax Committee, I want to know how we go about getting access to that offshore money that Google has. Can you explain that process?
Ms. Schaubach?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, I don't presume to know the ins and outs of all tax policy. I think House File 1440 and closing some of the loopholes that we have currently in our tax system is a start.
Representative Barrett?
And then just one final question. I guess I'm getting back to the $1.9 billion that you mentioned, mm-hmm. That the other gentleman mentioned as well. This bill talks about $36.5 million, a far cry from $1.59 billion. So I'm looking for information that really gives us the detail necessary to introduce bills that would write this wrong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, I read recently on those numbers, again, that U.S. PIRG study came out, or the report came out recently. So I don't know exactly how it all breaks down, but I know it is the $1.95 billion is kind of cumulative taxes and not just what revenue ends up in our general fund.
Representative Barrett. Chair Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I guess my question is for Mr. Michael. And that is, it's interesting listening to people, because I've had these same set of questions that both sides of the aisle are talking about here. And maybe Mr. Michael can lend some insight. I remember not too long ago the Star Tribune ran a big story about the couple billion-dollar loss to Minnesota in tax havens, and the Wall Street Journal has, and the New York Times has, and I've even saved some of those. I should have thought to bring them here. And yet, because I think both sides of the aisle are pretty conservative in their budgeting, we go on revenue estimates, and I think that's the confusion. In the Hornstein bill, and I don't have it in front of me, there's a different number, right? So we can see a different number. Okay, so it's 21,614, then it's 14.9. So people can, look at that. So we're hearing testimony on this big number, and then the bill says it would only raise this amount, and there's clearly this huge disparity there. In any case, I don't think anyone's arguing that doing Representative Hornstein's bill would definitely raise money for the state. No question. It's sort of the magnitude and what's going on there. And I'm curious, too, if maybe, Mr. Michael, if you can comment on what these national groups might be measuring and versus how we kind of look at our revenue estimates. Because, I don't think the author is claiming that his bill will raise anything bigger than what's on this revenue estimate, but I think it's just helpful for all of us here to think about what might be getting measured and what we might be thinking about as policymakers going forward.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, I must confess that I have not read the U.S. PIRG study, and so I don't know how they did their analysis. But a typical thing for an outside group to do is to use SEC data and other publicly available information that indicates essentially how much of their income is in their foreign subsidiaries versus their U.S. operations. And those reports also report dollars amounts of federal tax and state tax, all state tax. So it's very unusual when you look at a corporate report that it will disclose individual state amounts. And so essentially what an outside group like this has to work with, the limitation of having a total dollar amount for all state taxes, and then they have to use some kind of methodology to apportion that back to individual states. And therein lies the difficulty of how much credibility to assign to an individual number for an individual state, because they need to, you know, sort of make those kinds of adjustments. And it's a very imperfect, method to translate that SEC data to actual tax data that shows up on tax returns and results in actual liability. It gives you it might give you a good impression of the overall effect for all states, but I must say I have not looked at the details of this U.S. PIRG study, and so I don't know exactly how they did that.
Chair Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the pastor who was up here before, and Ms. Schaubach and others who are, I guess, still waiting to testify one way or another, and both sides, really, because I think the committee, the number is one thing, but I think that I'm hearing the testimony not really on what is the exact number, but what's the concept here. And so Representative Loon and I agree that these generally are regressive, although Representative Liebling has definitely opened some discussion on what parts are not. Having said that, you know, I do think there's a fairness issue for people psychologically that trumps for many of us the issue of regressivity, where we're seeing people go to great lengths to use some of these countries. And so why should we care? Well, that means all the rest of us pay higher taxes. That's why we care. So when someone gets a tax preference, everyone else pays more or gets less service for the same price. So I want to thank you, because I think going into the details and the numbers, but my sense is you're here really on the concept of this legal ability, not illegal. It's a legal ability for people to use their the different tax benefits available to them to place their income in these areas. And so I appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to let everyone know that I did not lose anything on the Cyprus. I was in time. But that was scary. That was close. So that you got to watch it once in a while here, too. Ms. Schaubach, and then we have a couple other folks like to testify.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, I think there was a question by Representative Loon earlier about our effective business tax rate. And I happened to print out kind of our comparison for kind of all the states, Minnesota included. And the effective business tax rate is calculated as a state and local business tax as a proportion of private gross state product. The effective business tax rate is 4.5%. It's lower than the national percent or national average of 5%. And Minnesota's effective business tax rate ranks 14th lowest in the nationwide, in a tie with three other states that are often perceived as more business friendly: Arkansas, Colorado, and Louisiana. So I thought I'd share.
Maybe you could have your people share that with Representative Loon's people. And
Mr. Chair, it's on the deed website.
Oh,
it's
on the deed. Okay.
Department. I mean, you can have this copy if you'd like. It has.
Any other questions for Ms. Schaubach? If not, I would like to get to the other testifiers. Did we have anyone else in the audience that wished to testify? Okay, so we've got about 3 minutes for three folks. So please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Anna Angeles Ferris.
And spell your last name, please.
A-N-G-E-L-E-S.
No, last name, I'm sorry.
That is.
Oh.
A-N-G-E-L-E-S hyphen F as in Frank, A-R-R-I-S.
Okay, I missed the hyphen. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Okay, provide your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm a resident of Hopkins, and I'm a custodian in the Lakeville School District. I'm here today to testify in favor of House File 1440. I've worked in the public schools for over 30 years off and on. Over that time, I have seen the impact that inadequate school funding has had on the students and the families that are part of our school districts. 28 years ago, I moved to California and I worked in the public schools. I saw the overcrowding in the public school systems there. They were so bad that the students had to rotate to the schools in shifts year round because there just wasn't enough room for the entire student body to fit in the buildings at one time. The school year was structured in four shifts where the students and the teachers literally had to keep moving their books and supplies from building to building to make room for the next shift of kids that were coming. After 4 years of seeing this, I decided I needed to move back to Minnesota. I was 7 months pregnant with my second child, but I couldn't stand the idea of my daughters going to school in a system that was in that bad a shape. I grew up here in Minnesota, so I knew what good education looked like. When I was a student in the Anoka-Hennepin School District, Minnesota was known nationwide for its excellent education. But sadly, over the years, as a public school employee, as a mother, and as a grandmother, I have seen Minnesota's education suffer greatly due to the lack of proper funding. We're looking at another state budget deficit next year. And this means that once again, we're going to have to ask some very tough questions. The bill before you today is asking you, what are your priorities? How should we spend the state's money? To buy down the tax bill of multinational businesses? Or to pay for our children to get a better education? I think you know what my answer would be. So I urge you, please, support House File 1440. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Angeles Ferris. And I'm going to ask the real chair how hard our time is here. I know we're done at 2. Okay. Any questions for Ms. Angeles Ferris? Okay, if the next testifier could please give us your name and who you represent for the record.
Sure. My name is Alice Flowers, and I'm representing a small business. And I'm here today. My name is Alice Flowers, and I'm from Apple Valley. I'm actually a constituent of Representative Mack. It's very nice to meet you. Last week was my last day of my job. I lost because my financial sector employer decided to downsize. So when the cuts reached my cubicle, I knew that I needed more control over my financial security. In essence, I needed to become my own boss. I'm starting a small business, and I think that the money brought to Minnesota through closing tax loopholes can help me. My dream is to establish a consulting practice as an image management consultant. I've got the right background for it. I believe the skills I've developed will transfer, and I'm ready to take the risk to be an entrepreneur. However, as I've delved into the market research on startups, I'm finding that in order to be successful, I'm going to need to overcome some barriers. For one, I need upfront investment capital. I know that there are services and nonprofits that receive state fund to help emerging entrepreneurs like myself. Now, my understanding is that this bill will raise $36 million. I'd rather see that $36 million be invested in the kinds of resources that will help me to start my business and achieve financial self-sufficiency and security. It could go toward funding additional education, more training, and make available loans for startups. So we have a choice. We have a choice whether to let the $36 million sit in idle in tax havens or be invested in folks like me, women entrepreneurs who are ready to make contributions to our economy, and we just need a kickstart. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify this afternoon, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Flowers. I appreciate it. I believe we have one more, and then just an announcement to members. We're not going to be having the meeting tonight, so when we adjourn, we'll adjourn until tomorrow. Sir, if you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Madam, members of the committee, my name is Chris Conry. I work with Take Action Minnesota. I'm here to speak in favor of the bill being considered.
Could you please spell your last name for the record?
Sure. My last name is Conry. It's C-O-N-R-Y.
Thank you, sir.
I'll make my comments very brief. I just wanted to draw people's attention to a letter that was circulated from Mr. Dan Bucks, who's the former Revenue Commissioner of Montana. It's worth reading through, just three quick points to make out of it. In his experience administering this bill in Montana for the better part of the last decade, There were no significant administrative barriers or problems they had in terms of implementation. The second, of course, is that it was revenue positive, even in a state with a less robust economy and a smaller population. And the third is that they also found that it didn't have any sort of ill side effects on the business climate in the state. They had no particular complaints from or concerns from businesses that were considering investing in Montana. So it's worth a good read, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Connery? Representative Barrett? And I think we'll wrap it up here after Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question for the testifier, but I'm wondering if it would be appropriate to have the department weigh in on the bill.
I think we probably better divert that. I think what we'll do is if we might have Chair Lencheski, if we might be able to accommodate Representative Barrett's request tomorrow. We need to vacate the room here in a timely manner, if that's okay, Representative Barrett. Okay, Mr. Connery, thank you. Just a few closing comments from the chair.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. My closing comment is just I appreciate the committee hearing this bill, and there's a Mr. Rucci was going to testify, but he's not, so he has a letter. That's what you're getting now.
Okay.
I just want to thank the committee for hearing the bill.
Thank you for that. And I was thinking Chair Hornstein consent calendar, but maybe not.
Yeah.
With that,
always a lively discussion. Thank you.
We will stand adjourned. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.